Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. Sean, I've known you for quite a long time now, probably going back a decade at least. And in my interview preparation for you, I was writing down a few things, trying to work out how to describe you to people who may not be familiar with you, right? So we've got fitness model, physique world champion, online coach, content creator, gym owner, businessman. And I thought, you know what? There's no point me trying to work out what you are. How do you describe yourself to people? Or does it depend entirely on who's standing in front of you?
Yeah. And also what I want to get out of the conversation. It's one of those ones where I think when you've been in the industry, probably as long as I have, and you have, you know, 20 years close to, you can put on a lot of different hats and speak to a lot of different people about a lot of different things. So, I did a podcast recently where someone said, introduce yourself in one sentence. And then at the end of it, they said, stop bragging. We asked you just to introduce yourself, stop bragging. So it's one of those things where I'd say, usually it would go along the lines of a gym owner and personal trainer for about 20 years, a physique world champion, and then a sort of one of the original kind of OG fitness influencers when social media kind of kicked off. So I'd say that those three things are probably what most people know me for. Or looking like Fernando Torres.
A very, very muscular version of Fernando. I think the industry has changed so much. So we would have first met back when print magazines, fitness magazines, were still the main source of information. That's how people got their info. The internet, yes, there was some very nascent websites that were doing a very kind of basic fundamental job. But since then, I mean, we've just seen the explosion where almost the print medium has completely disappeared. You're talking to people directly yourself. How have you found that journey from starting off as a PT to, you know, working with media and then talking direct to yourself? Because it's been a huge amount of change in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, I think the fundamentals of what I do haven't actually changed that much. As in, you know, the majority of what I do when I work with people is one-to-one, and that's kind of been relatively consistent over the past sort of 20 years. Is working with one or two people at a time, usually for an hour, and then programming them outside of that. So that sort of stuff hasn't really changed too much. Obviously, from owning gyms and from managing teams of trainers and stuff, I've seen what other people, especially with the sort of invention and sort of popularization of online training, and also the, you know, it being kind of forced upon us through the pandemic and that sort of stuff. I've seen a lot of people change, and certainly with coaches, change the way that they operate. But I was actually one of the guys that I didn't get into personal training to do it through a computer screen. And so it's one of those things where I was lucky enough to be able to stick to my guns and kind of not venture down that path and get into the habit of Zoom training and all that sort of stuff. Because for me, part of the art of, you know, being a really good one-to-one coach is that personal relationship, that actually being able to help and correct technique and that sort of stuff in real time, in real life, but also to be able to push people past what they think is possible. And I think that I find that very, very difficult to do through a screen. I also think that when online training kind of became more popular, that, you know, most people that work in gyms, they do it because they like the sense of community. They like the sense of team and the environment of being in a gym. Whereas I think when you transition more into that online training modality, you end up talking across a screen in a coffee shop. And that's not really something I was that interested in.
I think with COVID, as you say, so many businesses and individuals had to transition to online because there was no alternative, right? It was online, people go out of business. What do you think now that the dust has begun to settle, people have been back in the gyms for well over a year now, do you feel like the shift towards online personal training has been beneficial to the industry, or is it still something you see as detrimental just because the barrier to entry is so low. You could be, yes, you've got a global audience, but there's no real quality control. I mean, it's more competitive. How do you see online training fitting into the overall PT industry?
I actually think it's pretty good. I think what it does is it allows people that want to go into that sort of style of training, it gives them a lot of flexibility, right? So, you know, you don't have to be geographically located to train people. You don't have to necessarily be at a super high price point because the overheads of working in gyms, et cetera, isn't there. So I think it gives some coaches the opportunity to develop a hybrid model or even to just go full online. So I think having more options is never a bad thing for somebody professionally, because that flexibility is probably what's going to make them have more sustainability over time. I think where it might be quite damaging is people, you know, potentially people that were very, very good one-to-one coaches see online training as a progression, whereas I'm not sure it is. I think, you know, a lot of the times if, you know, we get into this game because we enjoy working with people, we enjoy being in gyms, we you know, you can charge a significant hourly rate if you're a good trainer and you know you're busy, supply and demand, you can charge a higher rate doing one-to-one in person. So I think a lot of the time we're in online training, and you know, maybe through Instagram ads, and you know, work on a beach, you know, from your laptop, you know, and earn six figures. It's kind of like, if you're on a beach, the last thing you want to be doing is working from a laptop. You want to be enjoying the beach. So I think it maybe creates a sense, a false sense of like what personal training could and should be. Whereas I think sort of like that retreation back to kind of the core values of PT, working with people, helping them, and doing a really good job caring about your clients and their needs. I think as long as that's the core foundation of your business as a trainer, you will always be able to use tools, whether it's apps, online, all that sort of stuff, to add a higher level of service. So I think online training is great, but it absolutely has its place.
You cut your teeth on gym floors, and with City Athletic, open up a facility. Well, must be what, over 10 years ago now.
So I'm currently sat in our third site, which is because our lease and our old site ran out because it was 10 years old. So we had to dovetail building one side by side with shutting one down. And then we turned the computers off on Friday and plugged them back in on Monday. So that was a stressful operation. But yeah, City Athletic is now, as a business, we're 12 years old, but we've been running physical gyms for 11 and a bit years.
So what a couple of questions. One, what's the hardest thing about opening that first gym, you know, if you can look back at those 12 years? And then secondly, a lot of people open one gym, but not many people open two gyms. So my follow-up question would be, what was the hardest thing the second time around? Was it the same kind of problems, or was it a completely different set of obstacles you've got to overcome?
Yeah, I think one of the hardest things about opening the first gym was, you know, I never had necessarily a super high business background. So it was one of those things where, you know, I was always a personal trainer on the gym floor. You know, I got a good degree. So it was one of those things where I could understand a lot of the elements of business and the work ethic that goes into necessarily running a business. But at the end of the day, my practical knowledge was from personal training, and I had a vision of what a gym could be and should be. And then it was just about trying to, you know, brick by brick, build that vision out into some sort of reality. The hardest thing, which I wasn't necessarily aware of at the time, was the hardest thing I think in any business is managing people. And it's, you know, when you're dealing with personal trainers, when you're dealing with fitness staff, and when you're dealing with members, you know, it's about managing teams, creating community, and getting buy-in from people so that they can share the vision that you have for the community and get on board with that. And I think as you grow and scale a business, I think the more people you're responsible for and you have to manage, I think that's when it becomes really challenging.
What is the answer if you've managed to find it out now? Is it hiring good people in the first place? Could obviously be one step. And then how do you ensure that as your team grows, you don't get any bad eggs or any toxic influences? Because I imagine that can absolutely just tear through a gym floor.
Correct. So we, you know, it's called a no dickhead policy. Like it's one of those ones where it's quite a common, you know, from a business point of view and from a community point of view, you only need one bad apple to rot the whole apple cart. And it's one of those things where recruitment is so key, and getting the right people that are aligned with what you think the level of service should be delivered, you know, finding those people and the people that buy into what you're trying to do, if you can find them, hold on to them and, you know, do whatever you need to get the most out of them, to support them on their journey. And then they just come along with the ride. That's the whole thing. As in, I was listening to actually a podcast a couple of days ago from a leadership mentor, and he was saying that the parallels between sort of managing people and being a leader within an organization is very, very similar to parenting. And it's, you know, your job isn't necessarily to make them better at their job. It's just to support them and create the space where they can grow and be better at their job. So I think that's something that over the last 10 years, I've certainly learned a lot about, but also getting the right people in to help and to, you know, when I need help and support, finding the right people that can fill those gaps, and then vice versa, doing it for them.
You mentioned parenting, which takes me nicely on to my next question, because as a father, I think it's fair to say you don't have a typical dad bod, right? This is managed to maintain a physique where most men have given up the ghost by now. I'd be really interested to get an idea of how you've had to change your training, how you've had to change your nutrition, how you've had to change your life based on Lidlands, right? Because it's a completely different kettle of fish. You can't just go off to the gym, do these other things. You can't come first anymore. How have you adjusted to that, and how are you finding the low-hanging fruit, the easy wins of maintaining your physique and still doing what you need to do?
So I think it's one of those ones where I think you hit the nail on the head, is that you don't come first anymore. And that ability to just, you know, go to the gym at the drop of a hat, you know, you can't do it. As in, you can obviously plan, and, you know, my wife and I, we absolutely operate as a team when it comes to, you know, freeing up space to, you know, if she wants to go to a yoga class, I'll look after boys and vice versa. You know, I actually said to her this morning, I said, look, I kind of need to get back into running because I feel so unathletic and so unfit that I just need to commit to doing it. And I said, look, I'm going at some point over the weekend, and for every weekend for the foreseeable, I'm going to need to go for a short run, whether it's round the block, whether it's 3K, 5K, whatever it is. I said, look, I need you to support me on this. She's like, absolutely, that's a great idea. And so it's about just having that commitment. What's changed is definitely the volume, as in, you know, running a business, especially through COVID, out the back of COVID and all the pressures and issues that had. Time is something that I don't have. And so it's one of those things, and also energy levels, like you get tired. And it's one of those ones where trying to make the most of the limited time that you have in a really productive and effective way is probably the easiest way when it comes to training. I train 2 hours a week, which is nothing. I do 2 1-hour sessions a week because that's all that I can do from an energy and headspace point of view. That's why things like going for a run on the weekend will absolutely add some value. But it's probably why the nutrition that I'm eating, which is pretty much been consistent for the last decade, kind of underpins everything that I do. So, you know, I don't bulk anymore. I don't do that sort of stuff. I diet relatively flexibly, but it's always good, nutritious food. I know how many calories I'm eating. I know how many grams of protein I'm having. And I don't really drink. So that's also one of those things, which is that, you know, we're talking about low hanging fruits, things that you can do that become habit, and then you don't have to think about them. You know, not drinking, easy. You know, not eating a load of crap, easy. And then having a good sort of base nutrition, and then trying to cram in as much training as you can is basically my strategy to try and get by.
I think a lot of people would be very surprised to hear that you only train for 2 hours a week with two sessions. Are you able to do that because of your lifestyle underpinning that, as you mentioned, the nutrition and prioritizing everything else? Is that because you're very well trained and you can go in and train in an hour in a way that no one else can, unless they've got 20 training history behind them? How do you kind of explain it in your head?
I think it's probably some element of that, but I also think that, you know, I've probably got enough credit in the locker over the, you know, credit in the bank over the last 10, 15, 20 years where, you know, I have quite a high muscle mass, right? So, and I always have, and I've never really taken time off from that in probably the last decade. So what I do is I go in and I lift twice a week, and it kind of maintains that level of muscle mass. And then when you'll know this, that when it comes to either reducing your body fat or slackening off a little bit, which is probably the thing that makes the most difference visually for someone. So like, I know that when I go to the Maldives for a month beforehand, my diet becomes very tight. Like there's no wriggle room. My diet becomes very tight and my body changes in terms of body fat levels quite quickly because I am quite muscled. So it's one of those things where at the moment, my main focus is to just maintain that muscle mass and keep moving.
But you won't even dial up the training, say, before the Maldives. You can get the body composition and the aesthetic effect you want simply by dialing down the diet.
Probably not. I might add in, or I might have to squeeze in another session here, there, and you know, here when I can. You know, if I'm being completely honest, but it's one of those ones where, you know, it's not like I go from doing two sessions a week, which is kind of what I'm doing at the moment, to doing six. You know, I might go from two, and I might better cram in an extra one at some point.
Okay.
But yeah, the vast majority of the change comes from nutritional tweaking.
I think that's probably the last thing most people want to hear as well, right? Because that's the thing they perceive as being the most difficult thing. An hour in the gym, you get a lot of upside from that. That's why we'd always encourage people to train first, right? Because you're getting more back than just the muscle mass. It's all of the other mental stuff that's going on. But I guess that's what you've learned and how your body best responds is that you can be very, very tight on the diet, move some dials and actually get quite a significant response because of the amount of muscle you just carry anyway. Is that the key? If you didn't have that muscle, you wouldn't be able to get those tweaks.
Correct. And that's the thing. Like I walk around at 90 plus kilos. So it's not, you know, I'm not a small guy and I kind of never have been for the last 10 years. So it's one of those ones where, you know, my resting muscle mass is quite high. And then when I come in, I lift pretty heavy. So like even the numbers that I throw around, you know, it's high intensity and low frequency. And it seems to do. It's a bit Mike Mensah-ish, you know, it's that kind of go in, hit it really hard, do what you need to do in that hour to get a really good stress response, and then do the same thing 3 days later.
But you can only really get away with it if you've done the 20 years of hard graft before to get to that position. I wanted to speak a little bit about social media and how it's taken over in terms of fitness information, specifically from that body composition point of view, and how it affects you mentally, because you're posting very, very regularly. Obviously, you have to as an influencer, you know, it's part of your job. How do you deal with any criticisms, any comments? Are you just completely blinkers tuned out to it? Or do you sometimes get a bit down by the amount you've got to post or feel an obligation to post? I'm trying to get a sense of how much you enjoy that content creation.
So do you know what? It's a really interesting question, because if you'd asked me maybe 3-4 years ago, I'd give you a very different answer to what I'm going to give you now. And it's probably due to the fact that for whatever reason, in the last 2 to 3 years, my engagement and sort of, you know, my presence on social media has tanked. Like it's gone. Maybe it's because I'm less relevant. Maybe it's because the type of content that I produce is, you know, it's, I used to like to go on Instagram and post photos and the odd workout video and that sort of stuff. I don't particularly like voiceovers and dancing videos and just producing content that doesn't feel authentic to me. So it's one of those ones where I produce less and less and less of that content. I've never done a silly dance on Instagram or TikTok, and I've never done a voiceover because it's just not the sort of, it doesn't resonate with me and it's not authentic for me. So I would say that I feel way less pressure and obligation to post now. I post what I want, when I want, you know, when I've got things to post that I think people might be interested in. So I don't necessarily feel like I need to stay relevant in the algorithm and all that sort of stuff, because at the moment, I'll be honest with you, it's just not that important to me. Like it is one of those things where I do bits and pieces here. I share what's going on in my life, but you know, I do it on my terms, and that kind of allows me to be in complete control of it. And therefore mentally, it doesn't really impact me in the slightest, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's one of those things when you've got a career independent, or you've built a business outside of social media, and maybe you're a little bit older, you know, we're in ballpark, right? I can only imagine though, if you're younger, if social media is all you've ever known, and you've built a bit of a reputation on your physique or your training videos or whatever it is, and then the algorithm hits you. I mean, that must be a very different kettle of fish, right? If that's kind of all you've got, opposed to, as you said, it's just one string of your bow.
Yeah, as in, I remember when it happened, you know, I went from having sort of a reach of like a million people a week on Instagram. Like my reach is like a million a week, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. And now it's probably 75,000.
Right.
So it's, you know, it's 90% plus down. And when it first started happening, I was, you know, genuinely stressed about it, because don't get me wrong, like a couple of years ago, it posting on social media and being an influencer generated significant income. You know, it was a large chunk of what I took home to you know, feed my family, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, when that started to be impacted, I was genuinely stressed and like, what is going on? And, you know, tried to get to the bottom of it and tried to have meetings with Instagram and talk to my agents and that sort of stuff. But it basically just came to nothing. And I was like, you know what? This just, it's not worth that headspace. And it's not worth that kind of toxicity that it can bring. And so it was just that I made that decision of like, you know what? It's just not that important. There's way more important things. And as soon as that enjoyment factor of it went, and don't get me wrong, I still enjoy posting bits and pieces on Instagram and social media. But as soon as that real love for content creation went, I was quite happy to just say, you know what? I'm going to do this on my terms. And right now, this is so low down my priority list. Like, I could probably go 2 weeks, 3 weeks without posting. And I wouldn't even think about it, right, unless I've got really interesting stuff going on, or there's a photo shoot at work and all that sort of stuff where I get involved and produce content, or some of the brands I'm working with, you know, ask me to do stuff, then I'll do it. But like, you know, posting content for content's sake at the moment is just so low down on my priority list that it doesn't really even register on a stress level for me.
And looking as well at what the trade-off has been, perhaps, is the bigger reach, but maybe not as much of a community sense, with maybe a smaller reach now. But the people that love you have been following you for ages. The same people come back and comment. I mean, it sounds like, I know which one I would prefer, right? It's a smaller, more community feeling following, because otherwise you're just shouting out into the ether, right?
Yeah, and I had this conversation with my agent last week, and it was a case of, I said, look, I think, you know, if what's important in social media is reach and engagement and stuff that's out of my control, then I'm not really that interested in it, because I'm not gonna jeopardize my own authenticity to get more reach for, you know, speaking in a voice that doesn't feel like mine. So I said, look, I'm more than happy to be pitched as, you know, somebody who produces good quality content that is authentic, that has 20 years experience, you know, pitch me as an expert in this field, pitch me as an expert in that field. At the end of the day, like, you know, I'm involved with, you know, multiple businesses. I have busy, you know, family that will offer value to some people and some brands. So it's one of those things where find those. Everyone else doesn't really matter.
As someone, and again, I hate using the phrase, you've been in the game a long time, but you know,
I have. I'm an old man, Joe.
No, I think it's a testament though, right? Because it's very, I don't know what the average lifespan of somebody in the fitness industry is in terms of how long they come in and how long they disappear. But to be around and to be as relevant for as long as you have is testament to what you're offering. But what I wanted to ask is, getting back onto that physique side, and I wanted to, an anecdote, and I don't want to name any names here, but I remember being on one of my first shoots. I was on the behind the camera. We were getting models in for a cover magazine I ran at the time, and someone came in who I'd not met before. They were quite a big name at the time. They're a huge name now, and he kind of grabbed me and said, "Joe, I'm so sorry, but I'm not in great shape for this shoot. Prep hasn't gone well for whatever reason." It's like, okay. Immediately started panicking. Oh God, you know, we booked all this. What are we going to do? Took his shirt off, and he was the most insane physique I've ever seen.
I know who that is. I know who that is.
And the thing is, that had almost, it was such a shock for me at the time that somebody could see themselves so differently to how I was seeing them. And again, not a professional eye, but a trained eye in terms of, you know, what should be there in a good physique for men of a certain age. But throughout my career, I've had this conversation time and time again with people who, whether or not it's a body dysmorphia, it's an anxiety, it's, I don't want to say eating disordered, but maybe a disordered eating pattern or habit. It's so common in my experience from very, very successful people. And I'd love to get your thoughts, if you're happy to talk about it, about, you know, have you ever had those moments where you look at your physique and think, I'm not in touch with reality here. This is because you're just looking at yourself the whole time. It becomes so hard to see yourself objectively, right? Because it's just you.
Yeah, but I also think it's I don't necessarily think it's about being out of touch with reality. I just think it's being your the expectations that you set for yourself are different to what most other people would set for themselves. As in, you know, if you're used to competing as a professional physique athlete, you know, and you step on stage in front of, you know, alongside 20 of the best physiques, professional physique athletes in the world, you're critiquing yourself against that level. Don't get me wrong. Like, and even if you're off, even if you come last, 20th out of 20 at the World Championships for physique, you could still walk down any beach in the world with general population and everyone would think that guy is in the best shape I've ever seen. But you are not judging yourself against the 99.9% of the population who are on the beach with you. You're judging yourself against the 20 people that you're on stage with. And I think that's where the disconnect is, because everybody else that's not on stage with you sees you differently to how you see yourself relative to those 20 other people. So that's, I think that's where potentially people that are in ridiculous shape and, you know, think that they're not, it's because they're not comparing themselves to, you know, the guy they sit next to in the office. They're comparing themselves to the guys they see on magazine covers, to the guys they follow on YouTube, to the guys they see at, you know, fitness shows and bodybuilding shows. And that's where that distortion of reality kind of comes in, because they're not comparing apples with apples.
Did it ever mess with your head?
If you ask my wife, she'll probably say yes. Like if you probably ask me, I'd probably say no. But it's one of those ones where I think, you know, you don't give yourself a break, if that makes sense. Like, you don't say, do you know what? Like, I'm actually in decent nick. And I think this happens as you get older as well. I think, you know, I think you get to appreciate a little bit more that, you know, there are certain levels that you can maintain. And if you go above, if you want to kind of dial in, the juice just isn't worth the squeeze. Do you know what I mean? Like, I can walk around at 92 kilos. I still kind of have a six pack. I'm big, I'm strong, I'm fit. I still enjoy my weekends. I don't have to train that hard, et cetera, et cetera. And I get by and I'm okay with that. Whereas like, if I wanted to really just dial it in a bit, I'd have to train more. I'd have to eat less. I'd have to, you know, ramp up those certain things that necessarily aren't, you know, that easy to do at the moment. So I think that's where the stress level comes in. And that's where, you know, that level of anxiety around not being in the shape that you were or that you can be can sneak in and start to have an impact on your health.
What would your advice be? I think because so many people it's very easy to start obsessing over how you look, what you eat, counting food, all these other elements that come in. And it doesn't take a huge leap for it to become something that can be all consuming. What is your advice for people who maybe are at that point of becoming a little bit too obsessed or have already crossed over? To, you know, how can you help them take a step back?
It's a really interesting question, because, you know, as you said, like there's a lot of people that suffer with disordered eating, and a lot of it comes around being in control, right? Or being or not wanting to feel like they're out of control. So a lot of the times it's they use eating and they use training to assert, you know, control in areas of their life where they don't necessarily have control in others. So it would also, you know, my advice on that would be to get outside of that box a little bit and, you know, spend more time with your family and friends that aren't that interested in physique and that sort of stuff, to take up hobbies that aren't necessarily physique based, to find enjoyment and find, you know, satisfaction and gratification elsewhere, that isn't solely around how you look and what you're eating and how you're performing. Cause, you know, I think that can be quite toxic. Having a fixation on food for the way you look can be quite toxic.
With, you know, winning the world championships, for having a cover model physique, all of these things that a lot of people aspire to, and they see the crowning moments, right? They see the photo shoots, they see the video, they see you with the trophy. Most people don't really ever think about the sacrifices that have been made. I'd be really interested, Sean, to get your thoughts on, if you can articulate, what has been the biggest sacrifice that you've had to make professionally to be doing everything you're doing, sitting where you are now?
It wouldn't necessarily be professionally. I think the biggest sacrifice you make is socially. I think it's, you know, I think when you're competing and when you're really focusing in on physique goals, the attention to detail and the commitment and the sacrifice that you have is all around probably saying no to things that you would want to do. It's, you know, it's making eating clean, eating accurately, training hard, making that the sole focus of your day to day when really it shouldn't be. You know, as in, you know, I probably most of my early 30s didn't see my friends that much, didn't see my family that much. You know, pat on the back for my wife for sticking with me, probably didn't give my wife the attention and the love and the care that she needs because I was so focused on what is essentially quite a selfish pastime, right? It's and especially when you're competing at professional level and you're going for world titles and stuff, like the attention to detail and the discipline and commitment that you have, you basically put you and your physique at the top of the list of your priorities. And I think eventually that can become quite isolating and quite, you know, quite selfish, quite inherently selfish. So I think that is probably the biggest sacrifice that, and you might, if you speak to other physique athletes and bodybuilders, I think they'll probably say the same, that it's some people love it, but most people don't. And, you know, being not on the same wavelength as your partners, friends, family is quite a lonely place to be for what is essentially a moment in the sun.
What, and speaking a moment on in the sun, what would be, if you had to pick one as the your career defining moment, is the, what is the one thing you are proud of above all else? I'm talking professionally here.
Yeah, from a physique point of view, it was definitely the 2014 WBFF World Championships in Vegas. That was for me, that was probably having won it in 2012, lost it in 2013. And then kind of having the what I would say was the perfect prep of 2014, and then literally going and it not even being close. Like that was, and that was kind of like the almost like the redemption story. Like I competed the year before, I probably shouldn't have done because I was sick, and it was one of those things where I didn't do myself justice. And then it was that kind of like, okay, focus, I'm going to give this one more shot. And it was that everything went exactly as perfectly as it could have done. And then that was it. And then I could walk away from the stage and say, do you know what? If that's the last time I ever step on stage, I am happy. And that for me allowed me to close the book. It allowed me to shut, you know, to say that's me done. And then I went and started a family.
Two things. One, was there any moment in your mind post 2013 to throw in the towel and think, I don't need to do this again? The second follow-up is, why was prep so perfect for 2014?
Yes, there was a time where I thought, is this worth it? Blah, blah, blah. But it was very short lived because I genuinely loved it at the time as well. And in terms of it being the perfect prep, like every prep I'd had previously had something had gone wrong. Like I remember, you know, the first prep I ever did, which was for like Miami Pro back in the day. You know, I didn't really know what I was doing. So I was just kind of blagging it, working out, you know, finding your feet and working it out. Second one, again, pretty similar, got a little bit better, but not much. Third one for the World Championships, I ended up falling off my bike and breaking my shoulder and my neck and all that sort of stuff. Not that much before the World Championships. So it was one of those ones where I was, you know, I was competing injured. With the 2013, you know, I was in hospital 6 weeks beforehand with, you know, cellulitis and MRSA. So it was, you know, again, it was a bad prep. So I don't think there'd ever been a 4 or 5 month period before one of the big shows where something hadn't gone wrong and I had to deal with it. And yeah, apart from in 2014, when literally I just had the most cruisy prep, I was ready to step on stage like 2 months beforehand. It was unbelievable.
For some people, that might almost be a curse rather than a blessing, because you might kind of start to overanalyze stuff. Obviously, I know you're a little bit laid back. Yeah. I mean, I could just see you kind of, okay, we can just take this really easy here. There was never any kind of temptation to try and overcomplicate it. Just stick to the plan.
Yeah, as in, thing is, you know, if you're in insane shape, and it's like that, you kind of know you are, and it's kind of like, okay, I just literally need to maintain this.
Okay.
Just keep it here, and just, you know, there's no crazy crash diets, no crazy strategies, no peak week, no nothing. It was just a case of like, get on stage like I am today, and I will win.
And you knew
I
that.
I probably had that a month out.
I spoke to Tom Stoltman recently, two-time World's Strongest Man. He said before his first win, he'd looked at everyone else and he just knew. And that sense of almost not resting on your laurels, but it's almost, it amped him up because he knew all he had to do was turn up. And it sounds as though you were the same. Talk me through kind of what was going through your head then, knowing it was almost in the bag.
Well, it wasn't necessarily that it was in the bag. It was that I was as good as I'd ever been, and that's all that I could do. And I was looking at it and go, I genuinely can't see anywhere where I can improve. All the rest of the stuff is out of my hands. And so I went there pretty relaxed and pretty confident in what I was going to do. And then I think the first time when I thought, okay, I've got this, was when I rocked up. We all arrived in Vegas. All the competitors arrived in Vegas a couple of days early. And the first day, like, I walked into the gym in the hotel, and like all of the guys I was competing against were on the treadmill walking hard. And I was like, actually, do you know what? I'm just going to go and sit by the pool. And so I went and sat by the pool, and I said to them, hey guys, when you're done with your cardio, come and see me. Like, I'm going to be by the pool. Come and say hi. I haven't seen you in ages. And then I went and sat by the pool and just took my shirt off, got in the sun, you know, drinking some water, getting ready. And I think this, when the sun hit me, like, I just turned into an absolute monster. Like, the vitamin D like charged me up. And then one by one, all of the guys I was competing about came down from the gym sweating, took one look at me and was just like, there's no fucking point. And like, well, after about five people in a row had said, this is done. Like, what? Like, I've never seen you look like this. We might all as well just give up. I was like, okay, like, cool. And that kind of, then I kind of thought, do you know what? I've done what I needed to do.
How do you feel now when you look back at those pictures, like the greatest shape you're ever going to be in, and with the greatest respect, you're probably not going to get back to that shape?
No interest either, to be fair.
But, I mean, I guess that's my question. Is it, do you look at them now like, oh, that was amazing, I'm so proud of that? There's never really a twinge of, oh, I wish I could walk around looking like that again.
No, because the sacrifice isn't worth it. There are other areas in my life now where I would trade. Don't get me wrong. Like, when I get in shape for stuff, like when I go on holiday and, you know, if magazine covers and photo shoots and that sort of stuff, when I dial it in and get in shape, that's how I want to look. That's as good as I want to look, because I'll still be dad running a business, all the other stuff that adds real sort of deep levels of contentment to my life. Like, I'll still have those, but I can still get in shape.
We've spoken about the career highlight. Is there anything, one big regret, one thing you would go back and if you could do it over, do it differently? Anything that stands out as, I wish I'd done things differently back then?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, like it's one of those things where I'm kind of super happy with the lot that I have. And so, like, in order to, all the good stuff that has come with it, you kind of can't have that without some of the other stuff as well. So, you know, it's like when you talk about someone, you say, oh, they've got a Lamborghini. I wish I had the Lamborghini. I was like, but would you want the Lamborghini if you knew what he had to do to get the Lamborghini? Probably not. And so it's kind of like, you know, the highlights that I've had and certainly the life that I live and the life that I love, like, none of that would be possible without some of the harder times or some of the things that probably didn't go as well as I'd hoped and all that sort of stuff. So absolutely no regrets, really.
Let me ask it another slightly different question then, in terms of what life lesson has taken you the longest to learn? Has there been something that, as you've got a little bit older, you know, you've been through the treadmill of having an amazing physique, injuries, recovery, anything that stands out as kind of you've come to a realization relatively recently?
I think probably that a lot of the noise doesn't really matter, and that a lot of what is out there that people get stressed and worried and upset about is largely like a storm in a teacup. So I think, you know, There's that. What is a, there's a famous expression as in this too will pass, I think it's called. So it's kind of like, you know, when things are going well, this too will pass. When things are going badly, this too will pass. Like it's one of those things where, you know, time fixes most things. So just there's no need to overreact on 90% of the stuff that happens to you. It's just to take it all in your stride and, you know, be resilient, really. Be, you know, I think it's that understanding how resilient you can be and that you don't need to necessarily deviate too much from what you're doing in order to get an outcome that you actually want.
It's interesting you mentioned resilience because, you know, confidence, self-belief. Do you believe these things you're inherently born with, or it's something that you have to foster and grow? Because you've always struck me as a very laid back, but also very confident guy. Mm. You know what you're capable of. You probably know what you're not capable of. Is that something you've always had, or is this just part of the journey of life where you gain some confidence, make some mistakes, come back again stronger?
Yeah, I think I've always been a cocky shit. Like if you speak to most of my schoolmates and my, you know, family and stuff, you know, they would always say from a very young age I was quite a confident, obnoxious kid, and I've just got slightly less obnoxious as the time's gone on. So I think there's always been some level of inherent underlying confidence there. Where that comes from, I don't know. I'm not sure if I was born with it, or whether, you know, in the formative years it's kind of come up, you know, and kind of grown in me. I was talking to someone the other day, and we were talking about, you know, why do we always look and why do we always aim high, and why do we always aim, not necessarily like focus on the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And I think we were saying that a lot of it could have been when we were early in our sort of development, that it was, you know, we were very extrinsically motivated. So, you know, we did things because we got the pat on the back, you know, and from that, and that kind of sets that mechanism in place where, you know, you are almost your confidence and your self-esteem is predicated on things that you do rather than who you are, right? And I think it's one of those things where early Sean probably was very, you know, driven by getting the accolades and, you know, and winning this and winning that. But then I think that suddenly gets replaced by levels of how you feel and who you are rather than what you do. And I think that kind of comes. So I think probably confidence and how you get that confidence changes over time. So like, I think when you're younger, you're certainly, when you're trying to find yourself and trying to work out who you are, then it's that, you know, what other people are saying about you and is important and giving you that motivation and drive to be confident. Whereas I think, and maybe it comes from having kids, that it's one of those ones where, you know, it's who you are and what you stand for and whether or not you can genuinely think you're a nice, confident, good person. And I think that's probably where it comes from. And if you have that base inside, then usually you'd be pretty chill.
You mentioned kids, and work-life balance was something I wanted to quickly pick your brains on, just because I think certainly for me, growing up and forging a career, it's instilled in me, you had to work hard, you had to make the sacrifices, go above and beyond. Feels recently from kind of social media and just things I'm seeing and hearing and speaking to people, there's a bit of a backlash against that and how it's so important to be able to, you know, switch off at 6 o'clock on a Friday and not pick it up again until a Monday. And these kind of competing theories of, you know, where is that work-life balance? Does it need to be all-out sacrifice? Actually, should you put yourself and your mental health before your career? As someone who's done what you've done and we've spoken about the sacrifices you've made, where are you on that spectrum? Is it possible to attain professional or personal, you know, potential without, you know, a huge amount of success that's going to inevitably compromise a work-life balance?
My biggest downfall is that I would always say that I'm the hardest worker in the room. So I probably work too hard, but I don't do it necessarily intentionally. My wife always says, you don't function unless you're overly busy. So it's one of those things where I probably work a 60-hour week every week, if not more. Last week I know I worked 72 hours. So it's one of those things where that's just because I think it's ingrained in me. And at the moment, the work is there that needs to be done. don't get me wrong, if I could clock off on a 4 o'clock on a Friday, I would. But I don't leave my desk until everything is done.
Does it feel like work?
It absolutely does feel like work. It does feel like work, but it is enjoyable. And it's also like, I'm not saying that I like to set the standard for what goes on in my business, but it's one of those things where, if I'm not the first in and I'm not the last out, but I'm pretty close to the second or the third one in, and I'm pretty close to the second or the third one out. And so it's one of those ones where if other people see me working hard, as hard as I can to make the business a success, then hopefully some of that trickles down onto them and they see that it's not just like a hobby. It's graft, but it's work. But in answer to your question, has that had a negative impact on my mental health, my well-being, my work-life balance? I would definitely say that my life is almost certainly skewed heavily towards work.
So how do you switch off? I'm not even just talking about the end of a day or a weekend, although I'm interested in your answer to that, Sean, but also when you do go away, because having spoken to a lot of content creators, holidays sometimes become more stressful than non-holidays because they feel like they need to be posting more, they need to be doing more to show they're away, potentially advertise themselves
to.
How do you switch off and how do you find that? Do you need an adjustment period? How does it work for you?
So I go to the Maldives every year for a month from mid-December to mid-January, but I'm going there and it's the best gig in the world. I work on a private island as their in-house trainer for a month, training all the guests and working with the guests. But because I genuinely love the one-to-one work so much, I don't feel it as being work. The other stuff that I do, the stuff in the office and running the business and managing the people, that is work. But if I can get to go to the Maldives, the difference when I leave for the Maldives and go and have a month in the sun working a couple of hours a day versus when I'm here working, 12 hours a day, it's almost like that step back is all that I need to kind of recharge and to get really energized. But yeah, I can't remember the last time I had a proper holiday.
Because there's never a proper switch off, because there's always something. Yeah. Is that just part and parcel of doing what you're doing, or anyone who runs their own business?
I think it's anybody that runs their own business that is responsible for other people and their livelihoods. I think there's always some level of burden. And don't get me wrong, like I could probably quite easily switch off for a week and everything would be fine. Actually, I know it would. 100% I know it would. But there's probably just something in me that doesn't allow myself to do that.
So what is the big plan in terms of the next 10, 15 years for you? And I'm talking about, new businesses, retirement. Mm. Is there anything the top of your list as unfinished business that you need to tick off? Talk me through what it looks like for you.
Yeah, priority one for me at the moment is dragging the gym business back to some level of profitability and sort of sustainability after COVID. Like COVID gutted us in terms of money, in terms of workforce, in terms of commercial viability. So it's been a huge task to try and to rebuild to a place where we're almost not losing money every day.
So how do you cope with that? The huge amount of turbulence and losing money, managing staff. I mean, there must have been countless sleepless nights over the past 3 years. Have you got through it?
You don't have a choice. it's the cross you bear, unfortunately. You got two options, right? One is to walk away and one is to put your head down. And for me, it was a case of my calling on that situation was to put my head down. And yes, would it have been easier to walk away? Potentially. But I wasn't prepared to do that.
So you just knuckle down and do what needs to be done.
And again, it's that resilience, right? It's basically accepting that you have to do what needs to be done to get the result that you need to get. And yeah, it's putting your head down. It's sacrifice. It's hard work. It's stress. But it's knowing that it will all be worthwhile. It will come good. Believing in what we're doing. And that it will get better, and it has, so that's good.
So what's your end game?
need to get the need to get the business back to a place where it's thriving again. That for me is kind of priority one. We have some interesting things within the business developing, certainly from an education point of view and from like a service delivery point of view, which is really exciting. So I can see that's absolutely a branch of the business where we have a skill and we have a good, really good reputation. So we can leverage that and develop that moving forward, so that from a business, we can almost just pivot away from our conventional offering and start to like move into other areas which offer new opportunity and are really exciting. So I can see that kind of being the next 4 or 5 years of my life. I'm really focusing on that. Obviously, I'm involved with the guys at Ghost over in America, and we're going through a really exciting time there in terms of the company growth and what's happening from a global point of view. And just, you know, their company's valued at probably close to over $1 billion at the moment. So it's
okay. How did that relationship come about?
Well, I've known the guys at Ghost for years, since they started, really. They were two guys that I knew from back in the day. I used to, so one of the founders was the poster boy for BSN when I was the poster boy for Optimum, and we were owned by the same company. So we used to be at all the trade shows and expos together. If we were in, you know, Columbus, Ohio, or in Vegas for the Olympia, we'd all be rooming together. And so it was like, you know, a friendship that came about there. He left to go and create Ghost with his friend from Cellucor, and we always stayed in touch. We always, you know, I was always a secret fan of what they were doing. Their products are unbelievable, and so it was one of those ones where, you know, despite me, you know, using Optimum a lot, they would still send, you know, whenever they launch a product, they'd always send it to me and say, "That's not what you think," and it was always really good. And then they were very clever with their branding, and they were very clever with their innovation, and, you know, small startup company, nimble, smart, like. It was just a really good proposition. And then there was always kind of like an unwritten rule of, when we're big enough and there's an opportunity for you to come on board with Ghost, we'll give you a call. And then they gave me a call 3 years ago and said, "Hey, look, it's time. Do you want to come?" And I was like, and it was at a time when a lot of the stuff that was going on at Optimum, you know, a lot of the guys that I loved and worked with there were leaving and had left. And I said, "You know what? I think now is probably the time for me to just say, you know, thanks very much," and to move on with that part of my life. And I'm really pleased that I did.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.